This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, December 2nd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Is the Electoral College a better way to elect a president than by popular vote? After George W. Bush was declared the winner in 2000, Al Gore said that he continued to support the system. Now he's changed his mind. Here's what he said at an event in Washington.
It's a balancing act, but I think the balance has shifted, in my mind at least, and I think that we should go to a popular vote. I think it would stimulate public participation in the democratic process like nothing else we could possibly do. And in the internet age, having people more involved, we got to get back to harvesting the wisdom of crowds in the United States. We've got to get back to the kind of conversation of democracy that allows good ideas to rise to the surface.
Jeffrey Toobin joins me to discuss concerns about this issue and about voting rights that have emerged since Donald Trump's victory last month. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Dorothy.
Whatever you think about Hillary Clinton, it's impossible to argue persuasively, at least to me, that Trump is the more qualified candidate. It's even harder to rationalize his victory given her lead in over Trump in the popular vote. It's more than four times greater than Gore's over Bush. So remind us, please, once again, why the founders decided on the Electoral College as the best way to select our presidents.
I mean, remember, the United States doesn't even really have a name. It's just the United States. And that issue of persuading the states to surrender some of their power to the central government was one of, if not the central dilemma in the creation of the Constitution. I don't think people focus enough on the irrationality of the Senate in its existence as a part of a democracy because, you know, Wyoming, which has 500,000 people, has the same number of senators as California, which has, I think, more than 20 million. So, I mean, it is not a democratic institution in any sense. The Electoral College is another form of giving the states power. You know, until 2000, there hadn't really been a big move. You know, people hadn't paid that much attention because the winner of the popular vote had almost, not always, but almost always won. Richard Nixon, interestingly, was in favor of abolishing the Electoral College. And it came fairly close to being abolished in the 70s. But now, with the polarization that we have, particularly urban versus rural, very red states, very blue states, the chances for any change are essentially non-existent.
Speaking of 2000, I want to go back to that because you are the expert on the 2000 election, having written a book about it. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with Gore today that this is just outmoded?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you and I have spent our entire adult lives thinking that presidential campaigns take place in the same 6 or 10 states, you know. Everybody knows that the candidates spend all their time in Ohio and in Florida and in North Carolina, and the states change somewhat each year, but by and large, it's the same group of states. If you live in Houston, you never see a presidential candidate. If you live in Los Angeles or New York or Chicago, they only come to these cities to fundraise. The one thing Donald Trump is right about in terms of this debate is that the campaigns would be conducted very differently.
Yes,
if we had popular votes. So it's not entirely fair to say, you know, she won by 2 million votes and she would have won by 2 million votes in a popular vote contest. She might have won by more, but she also might not have won at all. I mean, it just would have been a different campaign. You know, I don't want to overstate that the Electoral College is completely undemocratic. I mean, it is true that there are competitive races, and certainly the upper Midwest, which was the key to this election, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, which unexpectedly went for Trump. Yes, there are occasional surprises, but the whole nature of how the campaign takes place would be different if you had a popular vote.
So in 2000, we had the famous recount,
right,
in Florida with the Supreme Court's involvement and so on. Right now, there's another recount going on. Talk a little bit about the recount then and the recount now and the politics of how and why this happens.
The most important difference between the Florida recount in 2000 and the three recounts that apparently are going to take place in the next few days.
In fact, Wisconsin is already underway.
Wisconsin's already underway. It is simply the difference in the vote totals going in. The Florida race was genuinely undecided. You were talking about a difference of a few hundred votes. I mean, it ultimately was decided by a little more than 500. But if you look at the history of recounts, 500 votes can actually shift in a recount, especially in a state as big as Florida. So there was really a legitimate reason to recount the votes in Florida, especially given the screwy, kind of balloting that went on there, the different kinds of machines they used. I mean, the result was really up for grabs, in short. If you look at the three states, there is no way in the world that a recount will change the results. It is a waste of time. Now, there have been various conspiracy theories and various hypotheses that there was some sort of systematic hacking that went on by Russia, like the way that they hacked emails. But those are completely unsupported theories with no basis in the actual voting, as it has come out over the last few weeks. So basically, this is a grifting operation by Jill Stein, who, by the way, it now becomes clear, her vote totals in the three states were enough to swing all three to Hillary Clinton. So she is...
Even in, as our colleague Amy Davidson points out, even in just Michigan and Wisconsin, I mean, this is...
That would have changed... That would have made Hillary Clinton president.
And is there anything different between the thinking that she is now whipping up and what Trump consistently did throughout the campaign and his discussion of vote rigging?
Well, you know, as usual with Trump, it was never exactly clear what he meant by vote rigging. I mean, he was...
And he's still talking
about
it, by
still,
the way.
Well, I think that's significant going forward. It is certainly the same kind of claim, and it has the same kind of absence of evidence to support it. I mean, Jill Stein is making sort of general noises about, there are irregularities, and I think that people need an accurate tally. And, you know, it's hard not to you can't disagree with an accurate tally, but ultimately these elections are about winners and losers, and there is no chance that the winner is going to change.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
And what about the hacking question? Because this was a legitimate concern during the campaign in the final weeks and months. John Podesta's email accounts were hacked by the Russians. So there's understandably some confusion right now about whether they might have interfered with the election results themselves.
Well, you know, I think one of the stories that will be important to pursue in the next few months, years, is just the nature and extent of Russian influence during this campaign, which seems to be considerable. I mean, the hacking of John Podesta's accounts, you know, was one of the major news stories of the last month of the campaign. Certainly, you know, there was no bombshell in there, but none of it helped Hillary Clinton.
Well, and Obama has been pretty heavily criticized for not really issuing a stern warning to Russia about this.
I think, you know, it was an interesting example of how much Donald Trump got into everyone's head on the Democratic side that I suspect, I don't know this for sure, that the Obama White House was worried about, you know, seeming like they were stepping in for Hillary's side if they took stronger action. But this is a foreign power trying to determine the outcome of a presidential election, and Obama just sat there and did nothing. It is a bizarre thing. You know, just because you hacked emails, that really does not suggest that you have the ability, intention, result of hacking the results of a president of an election, which is a completely different technical enterprise. And there is no evidence that they did it. And they haven't bragged that they did it in the way that they bragged about the email project.
So moving slightly, but not entirely, this was the first election since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013. Tell us about the ramifications of that decision.
Just in simple terms, the Shelby County decision in 2013 said, in effect, that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was no longer applicable. Section 5 being the part that said all voting changes in basically the former Confederacy have to be run by the Justice Department or a court first before you can do them, because there is such a history of discrimination against African Americans and others in those states. The Supreme Court said that is no longer applicable, and immediately, like the next week, North Carolina, Texas, and some other states, including Wisconsin, which was not covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, made very substantial changes in their laws that made it harder for African Americans to vote. Most importantly, changed the kind of identification requirements you need to vote. This election is the first one since those changes went to effect. Democrats and others and civil rights groups did succeed in persuading courts to roll back some of those changes in North Carolina and in Wisconsin. But, you know, courts don't administer states. States administer states. And so there were changes. And it does seem like African-American turnout went down, particularly in Wisconsin, where there are very stringent new voting requirements. In Milwaukee, which is Democratic, African-American, 60,000 fewer votes were cast for Hillary Clinton. I'm sorry, 60,000 fewer African-American votes, and that means 43,000 fewer votes for Clinton than Obama got just in Milwaukee in a
so
state
you,
that
you
she
think
won.
This is not just lack of enthusiasm for Hillary
well,
Clinton.
Well, see, this is the problem. I mean, it is very difficult to count uncast votes in the first place. And it's also difficult to pinpoint the precise reasons why voting went down. It does seem like, obviously, that there was a lesser enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, but it was also harder to vote.
That leads us to Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who is Trump's choice for attorney general. Tell us about his political history and its bearing on this very issue.
Well, the most important aspect is that In the Reagan administration, in Reagan's first term, he was the U.S. attorney in Alabama. And that was the first time that the Voting Rights Act had been used to prosecute black people for engaging in fraud in trying to register people who shouldn't have been registered. Of course, the Voting Rights Act had been passed in 1965 to encourage black voting and to stop white interference with black voting. But Sessions and a few others used the Voting Rights Act to prosecute black people for fraud, and he prosecuted this group down there in what was widely regarded as a harassing act. They were all acquitted, and this was one of the main factors that led in 1986 to the Senate Judiciary Committee rejecting Jeff Sessions to be a federal district judge in Alabama, something that almost never happens. I mean, you know, district court judgeships are pretty routinely approved. But Sessions was voted down because his racial history was so bad. Fast forward a couple of years, he gets elected as a United States Senator, which he remains. I believe he's in his fourth term. But, you know, his politics haven't changed that much. He is a very strong conservative, very conservative on issues related to race, like affirmative action. He and Trump bonded over Sessions' very hard line on immigration, which is he was sort of the leader of the build a wall contingent in the Senate. And he's now the nominee for attorney general.
And likely to be confirmed.
You know, I think we are looking at a situation with very likely 52 Republicans. One thing the Democrats did while they were in power is they eliminated the filibuster for everything but Supreme Court nominees. So all you need is a simple majority. It's very hard for me to imagine Sessions losing, barring some new bombshell of Sessions not getting confirmed.
What do you think about the new effort being spearheaded by former Attorney General Eric Holder, Obama has now signed on to it, to create a national redistricting committee.
Well, I think they are showing real sophistication in understanding what's really important. Because, you know, these redistrictings, they only happen once every 10 years. So they set the political map for a decade. Both sides have become very sophisticated in knowing how to do this. It's just that the Republicans have all this power. So actually, as important as this election is, the next election is more important, 2020, because that will be the group that writes the district lines for the next decade. So in this respect, I think Obama and Holder are on precisely the right track. There's another development, though, that raises questions about their ability to do much about it. And this is sort of relates more to sociology than politics, is that one of the more interesting sort of sociological developments in recent decades is that people now live with their political bedfellows to a greater extent than they used to. I mean, there used to be more mixing of Democrats and Republicans residentially. But basically, it's you have so few Democrats in large swaths of the country that no matter how you draw the lines, you're not going to be able to give Democrats a chance to win seats in Iowa because the Democrats are leaving Iowa. I mean, I guess sort of one more general point is, you know, it is no secret to you or I expect anyone listening to this podcast that a lot of Democrats are distraught and people think this is like the end of the world. I mean, things change. They really do change. You know, in 2008, the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, the White House. You know, there was no Republican congressman in New York State all the way up to Maine. It was like, you know, the Republican Party was disappearing from the face of the earth. Now, you know, people think the Democratic Party is disappearing from the face of the earth. I don't think that's going to happen. You know, it's not the end of the world, and history didn't stop today. And Donald Trump is not going to just be able to control the federal government, to say nothing of the United States or the world, the way he did The Apprentice. You know, things are going to change.
We count on you, Jeff, to keep our spirits up. Thank you so much. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer and the author, among other books, of Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary from Jeffrey Toobin and others on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker app, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. Tell us what you thought about this podcast. Rate and review the Politics and More podcast on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Dubuff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.